As always, with my classes, I do treat them like they're a class. I do like feedback. I like questions. If it becomes really a difficult question that I can't answer, I'll just pass it off to Tobias. Let him take care of that. Well, Brian's here. I'll let Brian take care of it. But in all seriousness, we do want open discussion in a class. Don't want a lecture today. I'm afraid, you know, having been a preacher for so many years that you'll get me talking and I won't shut up. So we do want comments. We do want people to ask questions, make comments. Our topic this morning for this class and for this series that we're doing over the summer months is Watch What You Say. And when I got this particular topic, it dawned on me that you could really go in a lot of different directions. There are a lot of different things we could discuss when it comes to watching what we say. The text that we're going to open up with is out of John chapter 13. And it is rather lengthy, but we want to read it all and then kind of discuss it, kind of open up some things, discussions about it. Because this is one of those great moments, if you will, of an eye opening for somebody. What woke somebody up? Use that word "woke" in the proper sense here, and that would be soon to be Apostle Peter. Begin in verse 1 of chapter 13. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. And after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" And Jesus answered him and said to him, "What I'm doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Here's the part that I was talking about where it's an eye-opening event for Peter. Because Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." He understood the gravity. And we'll finish reading the rest of it in just a moment. But he understood the gravity, I think, of exactly what Jesus was telling him here. If you don't allow this, you have no part with me. If you do not allow this, there's nothing here between you and me at all. And so he says, "Lord, not just my feet. How about my hands and my head?" And of course, Jesus responds to him by saying, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but listen, but not all of you." Now, somebody just stopped right there. They might think initially that what Jesus was saying, well, Don't need to wash all of Peter. Don't need to wash his hands. Don't need to wash his head. That's not what he's talking about, is it? Because verse 11 answers it. "For we knew," or he knew, "who betray him. Therefore he said, 'You are not all clean.' So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments and sat down again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I've done to you? You call me teacher or master, rabbi, and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. So let's just stop there and make some quick observations. And again, we have, this is class time, open for discussion. I want you to make comments. But one of the things that I don't think maybe Peter, or for that matter, the other apostles had soon-to-be apostles, his other disciples would understand at this point at least, is that he wasn't necessarily just talking about washing feet. He's talking about service to one another. He's talking about waiting upon one another. And that's one of the things that I think sometimes we need to remember as Christians, as brothers and sisters in Christ. We're not here to be served. We're not here to have somebody wait on us, as it were. We use the expression hand and foot. We are here as Christians to wait on others and to serve others. And I'm going to make a suggestion to you. If we do that, if we all do that, is that not also going to point back at some point in time, now people are going to be serving me too? I'll get the service when it's needed, if you will. But if we're all doing what we're supposed to be doing, service is the point here. I haven't heard of them in a long time. Maybe people like Brian, maybe some others have heard. For a long time, we had what were known as the foot washing. I think they were a Baptist group. And that's what they used. Right? See, we're supposed to wash one another's feet. That wasn't the point he was trying to make here. It's service in general. But going back to this, here is one of those times what I think in terms of the Apostle Peter sometimes have been, I've seen this on multiple occasions, where Peter has been called the impetuous apostle. Why? What does impetuous really mean? Can somebody give me a definition of impetuous?
Speaks before you think.
Okay. Sometimes it's a matter of you act before you think things through, right? You do something out of what we might think in terms of today as a knee-jerk reaction. Well, this is kind of a knee-jerk reaction. Oh no! You're my master. You're my teacher. You're never gonna wash my feet. My feet are dirty. And remember the situation and the climate of that day, and they didn't have nice clean streets and sidewalks and things of that nature to walk on. Their streets were filthy. They were nasty in a lot of cases. A lot of times what people did, they threw their garbage out on the streets and it became part of the street over time, beating it down. So naturally, the idea here is, my feet are dirty and nasty. You're never going to wash my feet, Lord. Well, if you don't allow this, you have no part with me. You and I have nothing to do with each other. And this is one of those times where Peter would be so impetuous and speak so quickly, so act so quickly on something, and he didn't think things through. Yes?
Just a thought, but he was the total counter opposite of lukewarm.
Okay.
Reactionary.
Yeah, that's a good, that's an action.
The Lord liked him too.
Yes. Okay, that's an excellent point. So here's Peter, and by the way, this is not going to be the only time. We're going to talk about some other instances here. And again, like I say, as time will allow, I want to touch on some other areas about how we speak, be careful what we say. But here, let's make sure that we aren't as rash, as impetuous as some of the examples that we see with the Apostle Peter. Peter rashly told Jesus, and I tell you what, let's get some Let's get some readers real quickly. Cortland, and these are just simple 1 and 2 verse things. Cortland, would you read Mark chapter 14:31? Randy, would you go to John 13:37 and 38? And let's see. Leon, would you pick up the last one? I'd like you to do Matthew chapter 26:35. Okay, Cortland, whenever you're ready, Mark chapter 14, verse 31.
But he spoke more vehemently. If I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And they all said likewise.
Okay. John chapter 13:37-38, Randy.
Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake. Jesus answered him, will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me 3 times.
Okay. So you have 2 examples here, but let's go through the final one here in Matthew chapter 26, verse 35. Leon.
Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples.
Okay. In 2 examples here, Matthew's and Mark's account, we learn something unique. It wasn't just Peter that made that kind of a brash statement. The idea is, listen, Lord, I'll lay down my life. I'll die for you. This is my path in life. I'll do this. I'll follow you till death. Well, I don't know if there's anything biblical that I can find. I've never found it, but tradition has that Peter chose to be crucified upside down because he did not see himself as being worthy of being crucified like Jesus was. I can't confirm that. I don't know that, but tradition has that. But you see a complete opposite here, a complete change, where they actually have a mindset that basically is saying what? I'm going to die for you. I'll follow you to the end. Whatever it takes, I'm going to die for you. Would we be willing to die for our Lord? Would we have that? I'll get you just a second. Would I have that mindset that right today, if it became in this country right now, became an offense punishable by death to acknowledge my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, as just that, in order to be a Christian, would I be willing to go to my death if they said, okay, if you acknowledge that, we're going to put you to death? I wonder if we have that kind of fortitude. I wonder if I have that kind of fortitude. Yes.
It's very interesting. Peter and the other disciples, they're willing to die for Christ, but Romans 12, he didn't ask us to die. He asked us to live. So Christ is like, no, because these are the same men he gets Acts that turned the world upside down.
Okay.
So, no, in a sense, yes, die for me in a figurative sense, but literally, I want y'all to live for me and go out and spread the word as much as possible.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. We're told to not be conformed to this world, be transformed, that we may be a what? A living sacrifice. A living sacrifice. So it does amaze me sometimes where we end up with our thought process. Let's see, Tobias, since you raised your hand, I'll get you here again. Go to Matthew 26:75, and let's see, this is going to be a little bit longer reading. Daniel, would you mind going to Luke chapter 22? Luke 22, and pick up in verse 54 and go through verse 62 here in just a moment. Okay, go ahead, Tobias.
And Peter remembered the words of Jesus, who had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. So he went out and wept bitterly.
Okay. That's the first point. Luke chapter 22, 54 through 62.
They took they him, led him, brought him into the high priest's house. Peter followed afar off. When they had kindled a fire in the midst of the hall and were sit down together, Peter sat down among them. A certain maid that held him as he sat by the fire earnestly looked upon him and said, "This man was also with him." And he denied him, saying, "Woman, I know him not." And after a little while, another saw him and said, "Thou art also with him." Peter said, "Man, I am not." About the space of 1 hour, after another confidently affirmed, saying, "Of the truth, this fellow also was with me, for he is a Galilean." And Peter said, "Man, I know not what thou sayest." And immediately, while he yet spake, the cock crew. And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he said to him, "Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice."
Okay, so two times that we have recorded for us. In Matthew's account, it's really condensed. Luke's account gives us an actual, if you will, what we would think of today as a play-by-play, doesn't it? He's asked once, he denies it. He's asked again, "I don't know this man." Asked the third time, "No, you're wrong. I don't know this man. I don't know who you're talking." And it was such a profound thing experienced now, for when the Lord looks upon him, that he's called to remembrance. "You're not going to just deny me one time, Peter. You're not going to deny me two times. Three times you're going to deny me." And both times it says that he went out and he wept bitterly. I mean, you look at that expression, the concept of bitter, and it was a, if you will, I know we've all gotten a hold of something, put something in our mouth to eat it, maybe the first time I hadn't ever tried something, and it is just bitter to the taste. And it's like you can't rush fast enough to get that taste out of your mouth. I wonder if he had that in a figurative sense. Not a literal sense necessarily, but a figurative sense, because he had with his own mouth denied Jesus three times. And I've often wondered the connection, and maybe y'all would like to pitch in on this a little bit, but the connection as to why Peter would demand, I mean, Jesus would demand of Peter three times, "Do you love me, Peter? Do you love me, Peter? Oh, Lord, you know that I do." Now, I know there's some nuances in those words. I understand that. We won't get into that right now. But I wonder if there's some significance to the three times that Peter denied Jesus, and now the Lord is making him, if you will, requiring of him, "You confirm that three times." No comments. I see head nod, like a bobble-headed dog. Yes, Cortland, let me get Cortland first, and then I'll come right back to you, Eric.
One thing you see in John's account, here, it's interesting, you have the teaching setting of the rabbi, the teacher, the master teacher, and he is giving another lesson to his disciples. And in the midst of all this, you have the impetuous Peter, who declares him Lord in verse 6, and then he forbade his Lord. And he says, "What I am doing you do not understand now." Notice he had no concept of what he was doing. You mentioned the death of Peter. In John chapter 21, Jesus has a prophecy in verse 18 through 19, where he predicts that he will die. After he declares his love, his filial love for Jesus, he predicts that he's going to die for him later on. Also, in 1 Peter, written by the very hand of this apostle himself, who denied the Christ three times, and then reaffirmed his love, affirms it further in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5 through 7. When he becomes an elder,
okay,
he says you have to be willing to put on a slave's garment. And he literally says, "Become a slave to your servant."
Okay.
This very instance, Jesus, it says he took off his clothes. He is changing his clothes. Can you imagine just sitting in that setting and all of a sudden your master teacher begins to strip and then put on a garment? And that garment, by the way, happens to be the garment of a slave. And then he stoops down and begins to wash your feet. Lord, what are you doing? You don't understand what I'm doing, but later you will.
You will.
When Peter became a shepherd, like his chief master shepherd, willing to lay down his life for others, willing to be that servant, that slave, he fully understands. And that word that he uses is a word in the Greek that has this idea of taking off one's garment to put on the garment of a slave to serve others. And so it's just amazing how he says, you don't get it right now, but later you will. And it's just profound when you look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5 through 7. It'll fit right there at verse 7. You don't understand, but later you will. Jesus, the master teacher, is showing. And then he asks the question, do you know what I've done to you? Every good teacher knows how to ask the right question. And he asked the question, and you can imagine the question marks that must have been lingering over their heads.
So, good points. Good thoughts. Appreciate that. So we have now Peter. We're recognizing he's very quick to respond, and it does seem to be from the text that as I read them that it was first Peter who was the one who jumped out there and said, "I'll not deny you." The problem is the other disciples followed suit. It's almost like, well, yeah, what he said, yeah, I'll do that too. Well, you know, I'll never deny you. We're not. And so it does seem to be the case that he's the first one to jump. And I want you to go over to the book of Matthew very quickly with me. Matthew chapter 14. And we'll pick up in verse 25 here in just a moment. Matthew 14, 25. And Mike, would you mind here in just a moment reading Matthew 14, 25 through 31? Okay. So we have here now a situation where Peter would, I think, very quickly, I mean, maybe without really thought to what he was about to do, he petitions Jesus to bid him, Jesus, bid me to come out onto the water. And then just as soon as it seems he gets out there, And it looks around, he sees the boisterous winds, and I'm just imagining along with those winds would be waves. It's what the wind tends to do with open water. And sees this, what happens to, what does he do? He begins to sink. His faith wavered. It stopped on him. But he was so quick to jump. Of all of them that were in that boat, he was the first one. Have me come out to, I want to meet you out on the water. Well, come on. And Jesus had to lower his hand down and lift him out. Mike, would you read Matthew 14, 25 through verse 31?
Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out,
okay, I want to make just a couple of quick points here because we've already talked about this, and I do need to move forward on some of my other points that I want to make here before we're able to close this class out. But I want us to notice something very quickly. In verse 27, immediately Jesus spoke to him saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." The idea of being good cheer literally carries with it the idea of being courageous. Be people of courage. Why? He says, "It is I." That is where that Greek expression ego eimi shows up. That means the same thing as I am. You're talking to deity here. You're talking to everlasting deity, eternal deity. It's I. And then he tells them, do not be afraid. Well, the idea of afraid is literally don't be cowardly. Don't quake in your boots, so to speak. And he says, so when he tells Peter to come out, he does, but it doesn't take Peter long. He becomes afraid. Exactly what Jesus told him not to do. Don't be afraid. I've bid you to come out onto the water. Come out onto the water. You got this. Do I have that kind of faith in my Lord? Do I have that kind of courage, if you will, that when I read God's Word, what God's Word says, that's the end of the discussion. And I'm not going to cower at it. God has not given us a spirit of what? Fear. Okay? So I have to ask myself these questions sometimes. You know, sometimes, you know, Cortland made a good point. A good teacher knows how to ask questions and the right questions. You know what? We need to learn how to ask the right questions of ourselves sometimes. We need to ask ourselves sometimes and make sure those questions are pointed. They come home. How does that apply to Royce? Okay, very quickly now. Even Paul, before we get off of this main point here, even Paul would have to withstand Peter to his face. Because of Peter's actions, he acted impetuously and he spoke impetuously. Somebody says, well, where does it say he spoke impetuously? Well, notice Galatians chapter 2, 11 through 14. We're not going to take the time to read that right now because the clock on the wall is telling me I'm going to have to get with the program here. Note verse 14. They were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel. They weren't just acting hypocritically. They weren't just following Peter's lead in this. They weren't teaching the truth about this. Somehow, some way, I get the feeling that verbally, they were saying, well, yeah, but we need to make a distinction here. They weren't straightforward about the truth of the gospel. With that being said, James gives us a lot of great advice. If you remember, James was most likely, certainly one I agree with, is that he was the half-brother of Jesus. I think we learned that in the book of Jude. But James chapter 1 and verse 26, if anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is in vain. What is he saying to bridle the tongue? Okay, watch what you say. Have that tongue, our mouths, under control. Under control. Restrain. You know, if you put a bridle in a horse's mouth, that's the idea behind that bridle, isn't it? It's for control purposes. You want that horse to go a certain way, you pull on those reins a certain way. You want it to stop, you pull back on those reins. That bridle restrains the horse. It controls that horse. But I wonder sometimes if we understand the difference between what James would say there about bridling the tongue, and if anyone does not bridle his tongue, he deceives his own heart. And we connect that with James chapter 3, verses 6 through 12, where James says that the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird and reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man, now listen carefully, can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and it is, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude or the likeness of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does the spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, and or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring yields both salt and salt water and fresh. Now, notice that he says here that we can't control, or we can't tame the tongue. That tells us, in my thought process, this is an everyday thing that we do. It's a practice that we must put into play to bridle the tongue, to put it under control, because at any moment, there's probably not one of us here that hasn't opened his mouth impetuously and said something out of line that then we come back and wish we had not said. Why? What was the problem there? We weren't bridling that tongue. Why? Because we'll never completely tame that tongue. Yes, Leon.
I'm reminded about what the psalmist would say in Psalm 141, verse 3. Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips.
Okay. Put a guard over my mouth. You know, what's that saying? You know, to bridle the tongue. That's a good passage. Psalm 141, 3. Okay, thank you. You might want to make notation of that one. So the idea of taming is to completely tame or to subdue and make docile. That's the problem, you know, sometimes, because we're all human. We're going to do things. We're going to say things sometimes. In a spur of the moment, again, what we refer to sometimes as a knee-jerk reaction. And, I mean, I know I've done it. I have to come back and go, what was I thinking when I said that? Well, the problem was I wasn't thinking. Yes.
In chapter 1 of James, it talks about being swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. So there's your maybe antidote to the whole tongue thing in chapter 3.
Okay.
I try to tell myself all the time to listen and make sure they're finished talking before you say anything. And maybe you can give 5 seconds before you say anything.
Okay.
You know, it just, there's tools in the Bible that will help us frame ourselves, discipline ourselves, be better stewards.
Okay, excellent point. And how many times have we all heard the expression, God gave us two ears and one mouth? You know, let's listen first. Let's be careful first. And listen before we speak. Be what? Slow to speak. Swift to hear. I mean, there's that model is set forth for us if we'll just, as Brian pointed out, we have what we need in the Bible to do that. But let's slow down a moment. And what is that? We oftentimes sing a song, Angry Words, Oh Let Them Never. Okay, we need to remember that. That's a song that we sometimes sing. Okay, Raymond, I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't see your hand up.
What is in your heart comes out of your mouth.
Okay. Yeah, what's in the heart proceeds out of your mouth. So we've got to make sure that heart is right, that spiritual heart is right, don't we? Excellent point. Proverbs chapter 5, verses 3 through 4 tells us, for the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But listen, but in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. I find that interesting. That the terminology here, two-edged sword, is used in a negative sense. But you go over to where? I believe it's Hebrews. The Word of God is sharper than any two-edged sword. What's the balance here? It can be used properly, and a two-edged sword can be used what? Properly or improperly? It's just how we use those things. It's how we put those things into action. I've been doing some studying the book of Micah here lately, and I've kind of tied this one in here about the idea of the mouth and all that kind of stuff. Micah 7, it's a short, one of the minor prophets, a shorter book, but boy, it's got great stuff in it. For I'm like those who gather, verse 1, or woe is me first, for I'm like those who gather summer fruits, like those who glean vintage grapes. There is no cluster to eat of the first ripe fruit which my soul desires. The faithful man has perished from the earth, and there is no one upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. Every man hunts his brother with a net, in other words, to ensnare them, that they may successfully do evil with both hands. The prince asks for gift. The judge seeks a bribe. And a great man utters his evil desire. All these things Micah is trying to, God through Micah is trying to get these people to understand. And he'll culminate things, by the way, when you get down to into chapter 7, verses 7 through 9. Take time to read that sometime. Don't have it here. So they scheme together. Okay, the great man utters his evil desires, and so they scheme together. The best of them is like a briar. The most upright is sharp, or is sharper than a thorn hedge. The day of your watchman and your punishment comes. Now shall there be perplexity. Do not trust in a friend. Do not put your confidence in a companion. Now listen, guard the doors of your mouth. For her who lies in your bosom, why? For the son's going to dishonor father, and daughter rises against mother, and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Sounds like Matthew chapter 10, verse 36, doesn't it? So we need to guard the doors of our mouth. And I think that ties in real neatly with Psalm 141 and verse 3. Put that guard on there. Psalm 34:13, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Proverbs 18:20-21, a man's stomach shall be satisfied from the fruit of his mouth, and from the produce of his lips he shall be filled. Now, listen carefully to this. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it, and I'm going to say love it, will eat of its fruit. He's talking about death or life. Now, what are we saying here? Either righteousness or perversity. If the one who loves righteousness will eat of the fruit of righteousness, the one who loves perversity, that's what they're going to eat of. We can either use our words for either life or death. We can either use them to help people or harm people. We can say things that are right and good and wholesome, or that which is perverse and evil and sinful. It's up to us. Just like Brother Raymond pointed out, if it's in the heart, where do we have to start then? It's going to come out of the mouth. Where does it start then? Make sure that heart's right. Make sure that we're right with God. Proverbs 12, verse 18. There is one who speaks like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise promotes health. You know, speaking rashly and harshly, out of line, those kind of words are likened to piercings of a sword. But likewise, there are judicious words that make for good spiritual health. And again, you go back to Peter's rashly spoken words in John 13, 5 through 17. They would cause him to be grieved and even his spirit vexed over that. Contrast some of these passages with Proverbs 25, verse 11. A word fitly, that is properly, in season, spoken, is like what? Apples of gold. In settings of silver. And some translations talk about framed in silver. So you have properly, we can use that tongue properly. Now, very quickly, but as our time's about to run out, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. We also need to avoid profane language. We are absolutely, in my viewpoint, this day and age, we're absolutely bombarded by profanity in our society. You just almost can't get away from it. One of the things that Tony and I like are the old movies, the Western movies and things of that nature. Why? Because very seldom did you hear profane language in them. They could actually tell a story without profanity. Imagine that. Shocker, isn't it? But they could actually tell a story, and you didn't have to have profane language. But we see it, we hear it, it's all over the place. And I'm going to suggest to you, there are a lot of people in our society that use profanity on a daily basis, on a regular basis, almost constantly. They don't even know what's coming out of their mouth anymore. They don't hear it. It's become something that's so accustomed to that kind of thing. But as Christians, we need to avoid profane language. Okay? Profane is defined as that which is unholy or ungodly. It's worldly. Proverbs 17 and verse 4, an evildoer gives heed to false lips, and a liar listens eagerly to a naughty tongue. We don't use that word naughty much anymore. If we do, we think of it in terms of talking to a little child. Well, that was just a naughty thing to do. Well, interestingly enough, the writer of Proverbs here, I think this was Solomon, used that term to adults. Pay attention to what we're saying. Again, naughty means perverse. It means improper. Colossians 3 and verse 8, this is the one that really, I think, really nails it down for us. But now you yourselves are to put off all these. Now what? Anger, wrath, malice. What else? Blasphemy. And listen to this. Filthy language out of your mouth. What does the King James say on that? Do we have somebody who's got a King James open? On Proverbs 3, Colossians 3:8. New King James uses filthy language. I didn't think to look this up. I should have.
You also put off all these anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication.
Communication. Language. Out of our mouth. So, yeah, the idea of filthy here is to be obscene. Foul. Now, how many of us, stop and think about this for a moment, our time is just about to run out. Think about this for a moment. If you were to be walking down the street and you saw something sitting on that resembled food, but it was just nasty and filthy, would we put it in our mouth? Now, dog might. They'll eat anything off the ground. But as human beings, we would we'd be repulsed by that. Well, why would we be repulsed by putting it into our mouth, but we wouldn't be repulsed by spewing it out of our mouth? So, very, very quickly, Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt word or communication proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Again, the word corrupt here, that which is putrefied, it's rotten, it's unfit, both in a literal and a moral sense. Literally and in a moral sense. Yes, Sherry.
Royce, I think, so people do know what's coming out of their mouth. And the reason I say that, because when people are around me, for example, nothing special about that, but if they normally speak like that, they will not say those things. Or if one slips, they'll go, oh, sorry, Sherry.
Okay.
And so the same thing, you can also, you know, like students, not anymore, but used to, then that they would say something, or I'd hear something in the hallway or something, I'd go, hey guys, watch your mouth, and they would go, oh, sorry, Miss Ventura.
Yeah.
So I think they do realize, and they're more conscientious than we think they are.
Okay. I should have qualified that. I think some people are just so accustomed to it, they just say it, they don't care who they're around. But let me give you a real quick example of what you're talking about. I think it's a good point. Don't agree to his religious beliefs, and I know our time is up, but don't agree to his religious beliefs. But Franklin Graham asked Donald Trump in his acceptance speech at the RNC not to use profane language. He brought it up and said, he asked me not to, I'm going to try real hard not to. You know what? I don't recall one profane word coming out of Donald Trump's mouth during that whole thing. So maybe he is aware. Sometimes, if I think about it, I don't have to use that. That's a good point, though, Sherry. Yeah, some people are. Oh, yes. Okay, our time is up. I appreciate your comments and your input in the class. And for tolerating putting up with me.